Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
Keir Starmer has said that our world is markedly more turbulent in recent weeks as calls on Donald Trump to recognise that Greenland's future belongs to the people of Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark alone. Then later we will discuss what happens when what's good for us stops meaning us.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media.
But first, it's the Week Unwrapped. Hot off the heels of Robert Jenrick's defection last week, we have yet another high-profile Conservative MP defecting to Reform UK. This is the former Tory MP, former Shadow Minister, and still the MP for Romford, Andrew Rosendale. This comes, obviously, after Robert Jenrick last week and Nadeem Zahawi too. There are rumours that there are more defections in the pipeline, possibly from Labour as well. Ali, what do you make of Andrew Rosendale resigning from the Conservative Party and defecting to Reform on Sunday night?
Who's that?
Do you want me to refresh your memory about where you might know this man from?
Yeah, it's on the tip of my...
Yeah, okay. Andrew Rosendale, in May 2022, was arrested by the Metropolitan Police on suspicion of indecent assault, sexual assault, rape, abuse of position of trust and misconduct in public office. He had been under investigation since January 2020. He was a whip and shadow minister. In February 2024, the Met Police concluded that the evidence held did not meet the threshold for prosecution and no further action would be taken. And at the time, a spokesperson for Rosendale said that he's been working constantly for Romford for the past 21 months and will continue to speak up for the people of his beloved hometown as their local MP. This man is now part of the Reform Party.
So he's not in the right party, at least, no? This is the retirement home for former Tories of...
Disgraced Tories.
Disgraced politicians in general.
What I do find quite funny is Kemi Badenoch said last week after Robert Jenrick's defection that she was positive that there would be no more defections by senior Conservative MPs, which either implies that she didn't know about Rosendale or...
Or he's not senior.
Or she didn't care.
Yeah.
Which I'm actually team Badenoch on this one.
She used the line of the reformer doing my spring cleaning for me, which I actually thought was a fairly decent line.
Yeah.
What was clear is, you know, we were on air as that... By the way, huge regret. Apparently he has an online nickname, Robert Generic.
I called him that like three times during
on the show.
Yeah.
All right, well, sorry. I'm sorry about
that. I knew you don't listen to me.
No. I was a butterfly came by. I don't have ADHD, you know. So I think part of the narrative of what Reform came out with, I think right after we went off air, highlighted what we said when we were on air, which was this idea of the Tory party being like a Reform being a Conservative Party retirement home or a lifeline for like disgraced or politicians on the outside, people like Nadeem Zahawi, for example. And as a result, what's this deadline he's put on? Because Zia Yusuf was tweeting crazy about it, and Nigel Farage said sort of, we'll accept defections, but the 7th of May, which is the local elections polling day, is the deadline. So I think they're conscious of this idea that they're a Conservative Party sort of rebrand, or just a further right Conservative Party rebrand. But I don't know how this helps that. And I don't know how you can avoid that accusation now that you have consistent Conservatives kind of jumping from one ship to another.
Mm.
Particularly, you know, you'd think, given some of the stuff that you've just read out from just a like an optics PR perspective as well as a moral one, this is something you might want to avoid, no?
Mm-hmm. I definitely don't think Rosendale is a particularly well-regarded Conservative. I mean, he's definitely ideologically of the Reform ilk. He's a very staunch Brexiteer. But you're absolutely right. I mean, not only is it kind of a retirement home of failed Conservative MPs, but it seems that all the MPs joining are the ones who are sort of rocking in their chairs, deluded by the notion that it was nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
You know, the litany of Conservative Party failures.
It's also, not a single person is going to vote for Reform that wasn't going to vote for Reform yesterday because Andrew Rosendale joined, right?
No.
And no one's going to know who this fella is. So it's a bit strange for me, unless they're trying to bolster up, I don't know what, momentum maybe?
Well, the other thing that I think is a problem, and I actually wrote this in a piece for the Eye newspaper last week, is that previously, Reform was just kind of filled with sort of nobodies. You had a couple of, I would say, impressive, and I don't mean that in a kind of, you know, I'm not casting any moral judgments on them. I mean they're impressive in terms of their communication skills. So I'm thinking Leila Cunningham, for example, who is the Reform candidate's for London mayor. Mm-hmm. You know, she's slightly sharper and more acerbic than some other people in the party.
Really enjoy that. I think only a couple of weeks ago she wrote an article, Why I Don't Want Robert Jenrick.
Yes, well, precisely. Robert Jenrick marked something interesting for the party, which is someone as high profile as Robert Jenrick is not moving over to Reform UK from the Conservative Party without some assurances. Now, mm-hmm. I think we spoke about this last week. What do those assurances look like? The rumour is he going to be, would he be the Chancellor in a Reform government? Well, then you have to deal with the likes of Zia Yusuf, who definitely thought he was going to be Chancellor in the Reform government. Richard Tice, who is the deputy who always has leadership snatched from him at the last moment by Nigel Farage. I think the more you fill it with these ambitious career politicians with their own stories about who they are and their successes, the more you are basically creating mutually assured destruction, where you're going to have the people who see themselves as diehard, always were Reform politicians, mm-hmm. and the failed Tory MPs who think that they have the experience and should be parachuted into top jobs. And let's remember, Reform UK's party culture is formed entirely on X, a site which encourages them all to be as horrible to each other as possible. None of these fights or wars of ambition are going to be done quietly or politely or offline. I mean, if you think the left fights, yeah. I would love to see what a Reform Party infighting looks like.
But people have been talking about that for a while. I think it's one of the constant predictions has been that Reform won't make it to the next general election without there being a major split or a major sort of civil war between, because it has been the cult of Farage for so long. And in a way, that's an easier way to run a party when you kind of do have central command and control from Farage. But people have been predicting for a long time that there's going to be a split, that there's going to be some internal civil war within Reform. That hasn't come to pass yet. But the new variables definitely make it more likely to happen because you now do have sharks. You're swimming with very ambitious sharks in the likes of Robert Jenrick, Zia Yusuf, Richard Tice, Lee Anderson, I think. Shark's IQ is probably too high for Lee, but other members of the party who may want roles. So
yeah, and I would also question the wisdom of bringing in a Conservative MP who isn't known for anything except being arrested for sexual assault.
So there's rumours of a former Labour MP joining this week, is it, right? Any ideas who we might think of?
I've been hearing Kate Hoey.
Oh, right, that makes sense. She was a Leaver, wasn't she? She was part of the Brexit campaign. Okay.
Again, you know, I think the answer to that would be who?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I don't think Labour are too worried. Right, let's move on. Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer has not ruled out banning British under 16-year-olds from social media, saying all options are on the table. This obviously follows what's happening in Australia, where the Australian government have banned under 16s from using social media. Keir Starmer said, "We're looking at what is happening in Australia. All options are on the table, whether that's under 16s on social media or an issue I'm very concerned about, under 5s and screen time. Children are turning up age 4 at reception, having spent far too much time on screens." This is following Baroness Cass, who you may know from the Cass Report into Gender Dysphoria, coming out saying that she would be leading the charge to try and convince politicians to ban social media for under 16s. She said that she had seen and heard medical practitioners from all sorts of parts of the NHS talking about the impact of social media on children and the impact on their health, whether that be through things like radicalisation, extremism, body dysmorphia, and sextortion was another thing she flagged as well. I think this is really, really interesting. I think I'm really following what's happening in Australia with this ban because you know that I've always been a little bit more on the side of, actually, I'm wondering if a ban is the only thing that we can do now to protect children. The argument that is obviously made, and I believe this was also made by Molly Russell's dad, who you might remember was the teenager who took her own life after being subjected to self-harm content on social media. He kind of said, by just banning it, you're letting tech companies off the hook. What we need is better and stronger regulation so these platforms are safer. Otherwise, you're just saying, yeah, it's a cesspit. You can only handle it when you're over the age of 16. And we know that age of consents for whatever they're for are often kind of arbitrary legal safeguards. So it doesn't get rid of the harm. But I think everyone will be watching what's happening in Australia to see if actually will we see an uptick in reported mental health and physical health as a result of this amongst young people? Will it put pressure on tech companies to regulate better? You know, I think Australia's argument was, we can't force tech companies to do anything, so we're going to take away a huge portion of their audience, and maybe that will force them to regulate themselves. I think it's very interesting.
Why can't we force tech companies to do?
They're too big, aren't they? They're just bloody too big. They're too big, and we were too late to it. We were run by politicians who were too old to understand a lot of this technology at the crucial time when we should have been disrupting it and regulating it. And now we are playing catch up, and every piece of regulation that we introduce is about 10 years behind.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about this. I think there is something to be said about this instinct to just ban stuff consistently, I think, rather than deal with the level of regulation that's needed. It just seems like every day we're talking about a new ban on something. On the social media element, I do think that there needs to be something done around the content more broadly. I don't think it's just an under-16s issue. Obviously, they're probably the most vulnerable that are on the platform. But there is no reason why there can't be serious work done with these social media companies in terms of the general content that's seen on all screens. Because, again, like I don't see how you can make the argument that these platforms are so harmful and so dangerous to people, particularly young people, that we need to ban it, which is a pretty extraordinary move in terms of information that you take on, and then say, but once you're over the age of 16, it's chill, it's calm, everything's cool, you can get on with it. So there's definitely, and there are other areas of media that are quite heavily regulated, and the kind of content that's allowed, for example. Like, look at advertisement, right? TV advertisements, stuff like that. Pretty heavily regulated as to what can go on and what can't go on, at what times and things like that. So I do think there is an argument that we've surrendered to the big tech companies and the social media companies by suggesting the best thing that we can do is ban it.
Okay, let's just get to our last story of the week, because we're recording this episode a little bit early today. This week. Usually we record on a Thursday. Today we're recording on a Monday. It's actually Blue Monday. It's not only the most depressing Monday of the year, it's the most depressing day of the year. Ali, are you feeling blue this Monday?
Yes, mostly because I had like a 7 a.m. meeting, which I thought was a war crime, putting that in my diary this morning.
On Blue Monday, of all days, as well.
It's crazy. So this is going to go out on Thursday, right? Why is Blue Monday the sort of what is it? Because it's so early in the year. Obviously, Mondays suck in general. It's so early in the year.
So the notion of Blue Monday emerged in 2005 when this tutor at Cardiff University called Cliff Arnold calculated it using a formula that included weather conditions, debt levels, time elapsed since Christmas, failed resolutions, low motivation, and the urge to act. Which I don't know. I don't know how you calculate that, but. Apparently, Arnold's work was commissioned by Sky Travel to promote holidays, positioning the day as ideal for booking trips to escape the gloom. So I think it's a little bit of a, it's a little bit of a construct.
So the weather does suck today. I'm just looking
at
the window.
It's not raining. It's definitely grey and gloomy. Look, basically, January is a depressing month. Everybody's feeling poor since Christmas. Everyone's feeling like they just see the whole year stretch ahead of them, more work, everything.
The resolutions have already failed.
Yeah, it's cold.
The gym memberships have plummeted. How are you feeling?
I feel okay, I don't actually feel that blue.
Yeah.
Because I'm very aware that we have to deny Blue Monday's existence because it's just a marketing tool to sell us more crap.
I did read though that this year is the highest recorded levels of debt following Christmas.
Really?
Which I think is
Very interesting.
Concerning.
Very concerning, yes.
Just quick predictions, because they're going to go live on Thursday. I'm looking for an order, So for folks to know, we're recording this on a Monday, so we're kind of 3 days ahead. What do you predict?
What will we have missed?
Can you imagine there's some major story and people listening.
We could go to war with the US.
That's right. I could be on the front line right now.
Yeah, you could be conscripted.
In Greenland.
You could be in Greenland.
Would I fight for Greenland? Yeah, why not?
Yeah, why not? Got nothing else going on. May as well. Okay.
It's Blue Monday. Why not? Let's fucking go to Greenland.
Serious point. Do stay with us, because if you're listening to this on Thursday and you know, at that point, we've been.
This could be my last broadcast. Yeah.
Thanks for staying with us, guys. Yeah. Okay, that's it for the week Unwrapped. Coming up, me and Ali are going to be breaking down Starmer's attempt to stand up to Donald Trump and talk about whatever the hell is going on with Greenland. Stay with us.
Politics Uncensored on FUPAR Radio. Politics Uncensored on FUPAR Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Maloney.
Keir Starmer has responded to Donald Trump's threat of a 10% tariff on NATO allies for opposing US control of Greenland. The Prime Minister pushed back in a speech this morning, calling for calm discussion between allies and stating that Trump was completely wrong to slap tariffs on the UK and other European countries. On Saturday, the President Donald Trump said he would impose tariffs of 10% on the UK, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, France, Germany, the Netherlands and Finland by the 1st of February. Keir Starmer has stated that the decision about the future of Greenland belongs to the people of Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark alone. Starmer has also added that a tariff war isn't in anybody's interest because it will be businesses, workers and families across the country who will be hit by a trade war. He called it a very serious situation and is being pressed on the King's US visit, which is due in a few weeks. Ali, this feels like a massive step forward from where we were last week in terms of the rhetoric Donald Trump is using about Greenland. There was this kind of sense that he was talking about maybe taking it. He's been saying the US need to secure it for strategic and defense purposes because both Russia and China have their eye on it. It felt like European allies were kind of calling his bluff when they were going to station troops on Greenland to kind of shore up the NATO presence there. Donald Trump is still basically going ahead now and saying, no, this is nothing to do with you. It's only safe if the US takes it, which makes me think, maybe this isn't about defense and security at all. Maybe actually it's about something in or on Greenland that Donald Trump wants.
Well, Greenland is a very resource heavy location. Mm. And there's no doubt that that's part of the variable. I've got to say, thank God that we arranged two state visits for this man and simped so hard for him for many, many months to get a good deal. And I'd just like to give a quick shout out to the geniuses and these sort of 50-year-old men who have Sunday night columns in the mainstream papers who told the rest of us that we didn't quite understand diplomacy and that the way that we're dealing with Donald Trump is a masterstroke by completely acquiescing to his every whim and need, and that we've been able to bring him on side. So good job to those folks who've watched one too many episodes of The West Wing and think they understand diplomacy. The reality is Donald Trump, this is who Donald Trump is. He is a completely unpredictable lunatic who will only make decisions on his interests and to even a lesser degree, the Republican Party's interests and his sort of new imperialism that he has implemented as US policy from everything from Venezuela to Gaza to now Greenland. Mm. This is a perfect example of why we've been saying on this show to criticism from Saab that this man cannot be considered an ally to Europe or to the United Kingdom at any given point. He may align on individual issues, but this is not someone you can trust to be a long-term ally for Europe now that he's slapping tariffs on us, having a serious impact on our economy. And this all these months of like bending over backwards for him and rolling out the red carpet in this country and giving him gifts and letters in the Oval Office hasn't worked.
I mean, I agree with you. I guess you might say we don't know the counterfactual, right? We don't know what would actually have happened if we hadn't have given him a state visit. Now, of course, all these things have still happened. Mm-hmm. Maybe doing those things bought us a tiny bit of time. Maybe it stopped Donald Trump from smashing up something, you know, in that moment. But does it really matter if he smashes up something else a month later? You know, I think you're absolutely right that none of this was long-term, sensible, pragmatic foreign policy. It was literally, appeasing a toddler. It was like giving a toddler a chocolate bar, even though you know it's going to send them loopy with a sugar rush, but it just stops them from crying and moaning in that moment.
But that's a really good analogy, because that's who Donald Trump is. Donald Trump, at heart, is a child, right? Like, look at the way he's obsessed with the Nobel Prize. Look at the way he's obsessed with Obama. In fact, you can trace this entire fucking timeline that we're on, this multiversal timeline where it's, someone made one poor decision, stepped on a bug somewhere, and we're in this alternative universe. And it all started with Barack Obama, who I hold singularly responsible for these, for the timeline that we're on, because at that White House press, what was that, the press correspondence dinner, when he made fun of Donald Trump, seems to be the moment in which this villain was born. He is very much acts in an immature way, and he is an unpredictable actor. And that is the most dangerous thing, I think, in the international arena, particularly at the current moment, is an unpredictable actor who has no respect for international law, no respect for the norms-based, rules-based order that the world has claimed, even though it hasn't, has claimed, has governed the way states act with each other. And that is why, at the time, the way that we were sort of acquiescing and bending to his every need, I criticized, because while you may have small wins here and there, Donald Trump will always act in the interest of Donald Trump and Donald Trump alone. Like, look at the way now he's kind of talking to the Venezuelan opposition leader after having violated international law and kidnapped Maduro. No matter what you think of Maduro, this Gaza peace board that he's put together that doesn't have a single Palestinian voice on it. An unpredictable actor needs to be met with strength. We need to have confidence in the UK, our country, and our policies to meet him with strength. The best example of this, actually, is look at the way Mamdani dealt with him. Look at the way Turkey dealt with him. Look at the way some of the, the rumors and reports are that part of the reason he didn't intervene militarily in Iran is because the Arab states intervened and said no. So this kind of approaching Donald Trump in the traditional special relationship doctrine of thinking is completely wrong. These tariffs are going to seriously hurt our economy. There are serious threats to our economy. And not just the 10% that's going to hit on the 1st of February, but he's threatened to increase that into 25%. He's also, by the way, from the Oval Office, not ruled out military conflict with Europe.
Yeah. So, okay, I understand your point. I guess my question is, If you're saying we need to be strong and stand up to him and say, no, you can't have Greenland, he's going to slap those tariffs on us. The thing to do to avoid those tariffs, presumably, is to give him Greenland. So what do you think the UK should be doing? What should Keir Starmer be doing right now?
I'd be looking at retaliatory tariffs, for sure. Although I think Starmer's right in that a tariff trade war hurts us because they're in a stronger position than we are from an economic standpoint and a trade standpoint. But what can't happen is that he hits us with tariffs and we do nothing, in essence, and we just ring him on the phone a couple of times and say, please, sir, no more, sir. Sure.
It's worth just pointing out, he was asked twice this morning in the press conference if he would go ahead with the retaliatory tariffs. And he didn't exactly rule it out, but he said that a trade war is not in the interest of the UK and his job is to make sure it doesn't get to that point. But he also said threatening tariffs on allies is a wrong thing to do, completely wrong. You could think he was talking about that from Donald Trump's perspective or the UK's. But it also sounded to me like he didn't really want to commit to any. It kind of sounded like to me like maybe things were on the table, right?
Yeah. Look, there are all sorts of options on the table. Things like, we have many US bases here and across Greenland. I think we have multiple US bases in Greenland. These aren't options that I'm openly advocating that we should do, but things that we should explore. What I'm saying is, I don't think the strategy of just appeasing him on every single issue works. Because again, we have to have a very clear-eyed understanding that Donald Trump is implementing a new sort of imperialistic model of how America deals in its international affairs. And that he will only make decisions on his own, not even America's best interest, but his own best interest. And there's I think the king is doing a state visit to the US, for example. I would be calling up King Charles and saying that can't take place now. But there will be multiple levers at our disposal to pull at this point. And not just us, by the way. European partners are in agreement here, I think. So it's you listed the countries: Norway, Sweden, France, Germany, Netherlands, Finland. you know, the European Union could look at how it retaliates. It would have been nice, by the way, at this point, to be in some sort of like a economic and political
union
of some sort of Europe, yeah, make us stronger. Someone should look into that idea.
I mean, this was the point I was going to make. You know, I agree with so many of the things you said, but ultimately we are in the weakest position, yeah, we could possibly be in, and that is completely self-inflicted. And we have to say
he knows that
it's not entirely Keir Starmer's fault.
No. The reality is that there is one issue that so I'm going to let you in on a conversation I had. I had a sort of roundtable with some of the folks in Congress when I was in DC, and they were actually asking me. They were curious as to why the UK was so soft on Donald Trump, mm, particularly as their perception was a sort of a centre-left government has won in the UK in 2024. And my perspective to them was because the reality is the UK knows that as far as national security goes, particularly in Europe and with Russian aggression, we can't defend ourselves.
Yeah.
I think Donald Trump clearly knows that. Mm. Europe in general is entirely reliant on US military support with Russian aggression on the continent.
So let me ask you this. Is there a little bit of a conflict here for the left to consider, which is that on the one hand, they're like, you need to be extremely strong against Donald Trump, Keir Starmer. You need to be prepared to extricate yourself from him entirely. You need to be prepared to cozy up with the EU. Now, providing we're not talking about the left that denies Putin is an aggressive force in Europe,
yeah,
we are therefore maybe saying that the UK has to then maybe spend more on its own defence than we are currently spending, right? If we're not going to rely so much on the US,
yeah,
we're going to have to rely on ourselves a bit more.
No, I don't think it's about spending more money. It may be, to be really frank, because it's important in these areas people are clear when they don't know what entirely what they're talking about. I don't know entirely what the US and UK military budget looks like and what's required for sort of a minimum standard of defence. But I'm not entirely convinced that it's about spending more money. I am more convinced that it requires better cooperation and alignment with European partners across at least Western Europe, if not all of Europe. That is what's more convincing to me, some closer alignment in terms of security.
Sure, but at the minute, when we're talking about NATO, and NATO is the first defence against Russian aggression, right? If we are talking about extricating the NATO partnership from the US, because we are talking about the US potentially invading a NATO state.
In terms of Article 5.
I think it explodes. Like, I think it disintegrates at the seams. But then we have lost a huge amount of military and defence power, a lot of defence systems, which we depend on the US. We're entirely linked up with them on that. That aggression hasn't gone away. So we have to find those military resources and capabilities from elsewhere, presumably from our own budget.
Yeah, but I also don't think what I'm not suggesting, and I don't think most people, reasonable people on the left are suggesting, is a complete breakaway from the United States. What I think is it's dealing with the United States where they currently are.
Okay, I'm going to push you again. If Donald Trump does invade Greenland... Yeah. Do you think we can salvage a relationship when one NATO state invades another?
Zoe, at the time of air of this current episode, I'm on the Greenland front line. Yes.
All these questions are irrelevant. No, anyway.
You know what? It might be worth getting a military expert on the show in the next couple of weeks or months to talk this through, because there is a question of what happens. Because I think they take it and we don't respond.
I think to me that seems like for all this posturing about it's just you can't do this. Da, da, da. If Donald Trump decides to take Greenland,
yeah, I think he takes it,
and I think that for all the domestic policy that Keir Starmer might have under his up his sleeve, which I think there's probably not a lot there, but. You know, we have domestic issues. We have cost of living crisis. We have the rise of the far right. We have our public services on the knees. You know, NHS waiting lists. It could be that foreign policy just dwarfs.
Yeah.
It just takes up all of Keir Starmer's time in office. Because if we're really talking about a disintegration of the NATO partnership, the UK having to fundamentally realign with the EU, that is beyond our predictions for really what could have happened this year. I mean, we knew foreign policy was going to be high up on the agenda, but we're 2 weeks into January and we're talking about potentially being at war with the US.
Yeah. I would love to know what's in those NATO articles.
Yeah, yeah. Stop this train. I want to get off.
If one country goes.
Shall we just briefly talk about what could stop Donald Trump from doing this, right? Which is the fact that there isn't a lot of domestic support for the US to go and take Greenland.
No, in fact,
even in the Republican base.
Yeah, so I read a report this morning. I don't know if you've got it in front of you, that supposedly some Republican leaders in the Senate specifically have told him privately that that's a red line. Mm-hmm. Military involvement in Greenland, not necessarily taking Greenland through fear, intimidation and tariffs, but a military invasion of Greenland. I think I read the quote would be the end of his presidency, is what they said, which I'm not sure would be the case.
So I think that is obviously a good sign. I don't think the American public and the sort of and a lot of the MAGA crew would be particularly thrilled about that kind of aggressive military action on neighbours. I mean, we already saw Marjorie Taylor Greene talking on social media. I mean, she was critical of the US's actions in Venezuela, for example. The thing I worry about with Donald Trump is that, as we have said at the beginning of this segment, he is not a rational actor. He is an episodic man that just does whatever he feels personally enriches him. In that moment, that doesn't mean he's thinking about his party, his country, his ideology. It is about Donald Trump. Donald Trump is facing several domestic challenges at home.
He's going to lose the House.
Epstein files, midterms, the economy, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the MAGA rebellions, leadership challenges probably starting to swirl. He is a old authoritarian, episodic, psychopathic, narcissistic man. When the walls close in around those figures in history, do they go, oh, you know what, the jig is up, you're right? Yeah. Or do they say, sorry, I actually have to cancel elections.
Yeah.
We're at war. I have to do this, I have to do that. There won't be another election. In fact, I need to stay on for another term. In fact, they lock themselves in the bunker and they go crazier and crazier and they do things to detract from all those issues at home. They have emergency decrees, they seize power, they send the secret police out. I mean, I know this sounds hysterical, but if we look at history, it kind of warns us about what happens with someone like Donald Trump.
I'm sorry, Donald Trump has scrambled the National Guard in DC and across cities. ISIS shooting people in the face.
Yeah, we're not a million miles away from there. They already declared that the reason for going in and abducting the sitting president of a country was because he was a narco-terrorist. They are already redefining the boundaries of what they're allowed to do under terrorism and war legislation. So you can see there's a playbook here that he can follow.
Yeah, I actually think, you know what's interesting? My prediction would be that if there is any sort of moves on Greenland, the risk for Trump is higher of a crisis at home than it is European pushback, military pushback in response. I think losing the House is significant because this is where I do know what I'm talking about in terms of the US Constitution. There will be a serious challenge to him as to whether he needs congressional approval to invade Greenland and the War Powers Act, although they lost that by one vote in the Senate, I think it was the Senate. And so there's more likely to be an internal crisis in the American system, particularly once they lose the House, because I think it's pretty much assured that they're going to lose the House in the midterms. But I think you're right. You know, actors like this lash out and go even further in the bunker when things go wrong. I have an idea of how we can. I've been thinking about how we can deal with it because you asked me a third state visit.
Great. Maybe we could send a longer letter as well. Or how about a lovely portrait of Donald Trump just putting his boot on Keir Starmer's neck or something?
At every airport.
Yeah. Good. Oh, we'll send our ideas on a postcard.
That's an idea for all of you West Wing fans who have your Sunday columns in The Guardian, who are such experts on international affairs.
A pop at The Guardian. Didn't see that coming. Right, Ali, we're going to go to a break now. But after the break, we're going to be talking about rising individual wellness and the declining collective community. I promise you that will all make sense when you come back.
Politics Uncensored on FUPAR Radio. Politics Uncensored on FUPAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani. Now we're moving on to our next topic around wellness, what's good for us. Zoe, you've written a Substack. First of all, thank you for introducing me to Substack. For those of you who don't know, I'm so out of touch with technology in the world. I didn't know what Substack was until about 6 weeks ago when Zoe explained it to me, but I do now follow her on Substack. And Zoe has written a really quite brilliant piece called What's Good For Us, Stopping Meaning Us, about how wellness culture promises control and self-care, but what happens when it starts to hollow out our shared collective lives. So Zoe, tell us a little bit about this piece. I read it this morning, and you speak a little bit about your own personal experience, but also what this wellness culture and
it was kind of personal. Substack is a place where I publish things that no one will pay me to write, so
but it's the best pieces.
It means I can sort of go off on one, and I definitely think if I had maybe pitched this as a peach, I wouldn't have been able to get all the points in I wanted to make, because this is something that's been swirling in my head for quite a while. The personal is always political, right? And the political is always personal. And I just drawing on my own experience of something you and I have spoken about, which has gone on a bit of a wellness journey myself, in that I decided I wanted to lose a bit of weight last year. I used social media, because anyone who has been in the kind of wellness space on social media knows there's loads of personal trainers and fitness content and advice on what to eat and counting your macros and getting enough sleep and all these kind of things. And being in it and doing it made me realize that I actually found it quite a lonely experience, because in order to lose the weight or go on my wellness journey, it kind of involved me being quite isolated and introverted, in that a lot of the things I did with my friends, which often revolved around going out for meals or going out for drinks, I couldn't do if I wanted to embark on this life. And it was quite lonely, and I realized it was affecting my mental health and making me feel quite isolated. And that made me realize there was this tension between the fact that my body was probably the healthiest it had ever been, but I felt the most lonely I'd ever been and the most isolated. And then this made me reflect more broadly on wellness and wellness culture. And it's something that particularly Gen Z is seen as this kind of vanguard of. Over the Christmas period, there was a big piece that was in a lot of the newspapers about Gen Z's New Year's resolutions. And the papers had an absolute field day, because Gen Z's resolutions were things like abstaining from alcohol, drugs, sex, caffeine, late nights. A fifth said they'd be taking daily ice baths, which was extraordinary to me, because like, how big is everyone's freezer? One in 10 said they were going to have regular, I think it was monthly IV drips. But there was just clearly this evidence of...
IV drips of what?
I think it's vitamins you get injected into. It's supposed to stop you from getting sick. But it seemed to me that this was a generation that is increasingly prioritizing individual wellness over kind of community pleasures like drinking, going out, the things that we kind of view as bad for us. And I was thinking a lot about it, and I was thinking about, actually kind of makes sense to me that young people might be prioritizing wellness when they are locked out of access to the NHS, for example. You know, they're struggling to get mental health, but also locked out of broader things that gave people a sense of security. So if you can't save for a home, and if you can't, you know, save for a family, instead you might decide to just work on yourself. You know, it actually makes a lot more sense to try and save for that monthly IV drip than it ever does to buy a house. So it seemed to me, you know, it made a lot of sense. But I was thinking, actually, this trend is shifting responsibility, because if we're all on our phones and if we're thinking about how we can work on our individual health and our wellness and getting 8 hours of sleep and locking ourselves away and not seeing our friends, we're not gathering, we're not thinking about the health of the community, nor are we standing up and demanding structural change.
Yeah, so I have a couple of questions for you, but having read the article, one is... Obviously, getting healthier and losing weight is a good thing if you need to, obviously, which I'm not sure you needed to, but you obviously feel better and feel healthier. But the problem with the health trend, as far as I see it online, is the extremism that comes with it. So it's one thing to have these like quite positive accounts and trends that encourage people to like eat better and exercise more, and I know there's a link between exercise and mental health as well, a positive one, as long as it's done right. But that seems to have, as anything with online, veered into more extremist views about, I think these IV drips are pretty ludicrous, the science suggests. The ice baths, there's no evidence that they work or they have any benefit.
It's
if they
disputed
might do harm.
Evidence, perhaps, yeah.
And then things like this trend in America, I made the joke about milk, but the non-pasteurized milk, which again, there seems to be some evidence for, actually does more harm than any benefits to it. And then this link towards, with this wellness stuff and far-right radicalization. Let's hold the link to far-right radicalization for now. Did you find yourself at any point in the wellness journey starting to take things too far, if that makes sense? Mm. Like when you are kind of deep into it, harming your mental health because you are taking extreme measures on like the food you eat.
Definitely. And I think it's because, you know, when you're getting a lot of this information through social media, you're surrounded by, or you're watching people whose job it is, who are making money by selling this lifestyle and these products. So obviously they're going to have the most extreme examples of it. They, you know, the whole, it was close to what we were talking about social media before. It is basically a massive marketing tool. So when you're following wellness creators, and I have to say, I'm not shitting on wellness. I think there's a lot of good stuff in here for a lot of people. And, you know, for me, I've managed to keep a lot of the good habits I've made, but try to be more reflective about some of the bad habits that were making me feel lonely and isolated and self-critical. But I think wellness has been good in that it's encouraged people to think about their own health and to be vulnerable and to think about, you know, how they can look after their bodies and their minds. And all of that's really good. But I think the problem is when this newfound care isn't moving outwards, we aren't directing it into the community. We are so obsessed with self-improvement. And that becomes captured by capitalism, by social media, where that vulnerability is funneled into products. So, oh, you're feeling lonely. Perhaps you need 8 hours of sleep and you need to buy this special alarm clock that optimizes your sleep. Or, you know, perhaps you're feeling anxious. Well, maybe your gut biome isn't properly aligned.
That seems to be a massive thing, though.
Rather than us thinking, actually, maybe I'm feeling lonely and anxious because I'm not going out and connecting with people.
Can I also ask, is a certain amount of it not also the we've spoken about it in a separate segment, the sort of death of experts. So much of this, the wellness trends that you log on to TikTok and Instagram and things that you see aren't coming from qualified physicians, but they're coming from people who don't have the medical expertise to talk about this. So people promoting IV drips and ice baths and whole milk and all this kind of stuff that don't have the medical qualifications to tell you the pros, the cons, the risks that come with that. Because that's what part of my problem is. I actually think one of the things society's struggling with now is this death of experts, where people are making political decisions, but also health decisions and all sorts of different decisions about their life from people who don't have the qualifications to give you that advice. Whereas previously on health stuff, you would go to your doctor. Yeah. And not that the scientific community and the medical community are always right, but at least they're... It's backed up with a certain level of medical expertise.
I think this is the fundamental tension of social media, because on the one hand, it democratizes information. You know, it means that people who aren't experts but who may have valid opinions can share them. But it also means it becomes fertile ground for misinformation and people just trying to flog snake oil. And the reason people are drawn to this is because, you know, people are unhappy, isolated, lonely, feeling depressed and anxious. That my point is, that isn't all because there are things wrong with you individually. Maybe that is a symptom of our society being a bit broken. And, you know, does this
not trend also not then link your self-worth to what you're necessarily seeing in the mirror?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that is damaging as well. When we become super kind of self-obsessed when it comes to our health, we're not thinking about actually the importance and of community and connecting with one another, and the fact that that is actually what humanity is. And, you know, I actually made a point in the piece about alcohol. You know, we're often told by influencers online that alcohol offers absolutely no health benefits at any level. I remember when I was going through my like fitness journey, I was constantly getting videos saying, you just need to cut out alcohol. It's not good for you. It does nothing for your body. If you want to be as healthy and as fit and attractive as possible, there's no use of alcohol. Maybe it's true in a very narrow biomedical sense that alcohol is unhealthy, but we know that alcohol, when used responsibly, is a tool that helps people gather together, helps people be vulnerable, helps people talk to each other. You know, there's nothing wrong with having a glass of wine with your friend, with going to the pub after work with colleagues for drinks. It might not be the physically healthiest thing you can do, but if it's good for local businesses, if it's good for making people feel less lonely, if it's good for people connecting, first dates, chewing over problems, dealing with a hard day's work, then it's good for us. And I think the point of the piece is we need to stop thinking about what's good for us at an individual level. We need to also think about what's good for our community, because all of this wellness stuff is happening and rising and getting more popular at the same time that pubs, cafes and restaurants mm-hmm. are all closing down. And I don't think those things are incidental.
No, we've spoken about that before as well, because they're not just places of nourishment. They're also places of socialization.
Community.
And community.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about this, the link between wellness and the far right radicalization, because this sort of, the wellness culture does seem very prominent in far right radicalization, to the point where it's kind of this RFK doing chin-ups, sort of. That's what good politics is.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty well-established link now, especially for women, which is really interesting. Women in the far right.
Oh, really? Okay.
I would have thought it was guys. For men as well. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I got a few people email me after saying they are... I'm a guy who's actually a gym instructor. He said to me he's seen a lot of men get really into fitness and they get results really, really quickly. And that entitlement... Yeah. follows them into their personal life. So just because they get really hench in the gym, suddenly they're like, well, why don't I also have a girlfriend or a promotion or a new car?
Yeah. Which I think TikTok told me that this was the only thing in my way.
Yeah.
Right. So now I'm owed women.
And it's that kind of hyper-masculine, you know, that kind of like, you can just go out and get it if you really want it thing. But yeah, no, the wellness culture to far-right radicalization pipeline is quite well documented and by people who know far more about it than me. But it's kind of how these spaces that glorify, you know, discipline, purity, abstention, you can see how quickly they'd slide into moral policing, control, submission. And, you know, that kind of obsession with things that are natural or organic or whole earth, you can kind of see how they would fall into blood and soil nationalism or this kind of focus on purity or, you know, what's natural and what's real. And you actually see this quite a lot in female fitness communities in the kind of more niche ends. About the contraceptive pill and contraception. So there are a lot of these far-right rabbit holes are, you know, the contraception's messing with your hormones, it's not natural, come off it, and then very quickly you get to the point of actually women shouldn't be on birth control at all.
This is my beef, Zoe. And for me, by the way, this comes from a personal point. I don't think I've ever said this publicly, but like in 2017, I put on a lot of weight, and I, as everybody now knows, I used to be a wrestler, that used to be my job. And I'd kind of gotten sick with the fact that post-wrestling career, because I broke my neck, my health issue was a problem. So I lost something to the tune of about 35 kilograms in like 8 weeks.
Jesus.
In this sort of, and I went into this extremism tirade in terms of health. And as a result, ended up in hospital with liver failure and cholecystitis and had to have surgery. And I was like, for 5 days I was in the ICU and fucked, because I'd taken an extremist view on it, which is why I continuously talk about, if you're going to take serious actions on health, then don't listen to a TikTok or an influencer, but you have to listen to a medical professional, right? And look at the research and look at the data. And that seems to, that extremism, I think, is driven by a lack of medical advice, because any good physician, I think, on the alcohol stuff, obviously I don't drink alcohol for religious reasons, but on the alcohol stuff, I think all reasonable physicians would tell you it's about moderation, it's about right uses in the right spaces, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that medical decisions are made on the basis of costs and benefits rather than something always being right and something always being wrong.
I mean, the point I make in the piece is it should all be about moderation. I think as well there is a political government plea in this piece, which is that, you know, we're seeing the uptake of weight loss drugs, which is great. You know, we're thinking about how can we put less pressure on the NHS? How can we encourage people to take their health into their own hands? All of that is great. I have absolutely no judgment at all on anyone who does anything like that to try and improve their health. Of course, you know, you should do what's right for you. But the government also needs to think about what is healthy for community. And we know at the minute, you know, we're seeing a rise in the far right. We're seeing people feeling more isolated and disconnected and suspicious of each other. I think these things are all related. We also have to think of health, not just individually, but, you know, that community spaces, shared spaces, affordable places to gather. If you know, everybody's thinner drinking less and gathering less, and they look healthier on paper. But if they're lonelier and angrier and more fragmented, then we can't think of ourselves as a healthy nation.
Yeah, health isn't just physical body, I guess, is what you're saying as well. It's community and mental health.
Precise.
As well.
That is it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday, where we're going to be unwrapping the week's political talking points. That is, of course, at 5 p.m.
You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.